when we use the word revolutionary, we're talking about what Jesus did. We're talking about the definition of revolutionary, which is it's something that causes or inaugurates a dramatic or complete change. And the essence of where we're going with this series is that Jesus did not bring a new and improved version or a continuation of the religious model of relating to God that had been happening for centuries before. It was revolutionary in every sense of the word. And failing to let go of the way things used to be in the religious model, it's a little bit scary. It's hard to do, but it's a little bit scary because it makes Christians and Christianity and church resistible, or even worse, it makes others feel unsafe about Christians. And if you weren't here last week and you're interested in where we're going, this is part two of kind of five parts, I would encourage you just check out our website. You can check out last week's teaching if you're interested, kind of see where it went. But there's also a PDF of some questions that you can download, because we think some of the things that we're going to talk about, particularly this morning and next couple weeks, we need to process. We need to work through it because they're going to be a little bit unsettling. I think it's going to be a little uncomfortable for some. Also, afterwards, you're going to see on the desk back there at the table, there's these little cards that say, I've got a question. And so if you're here this morning and a question comes up as a result of something I've said or something that you've been thinking about from last week with regards to this series, just write it down before you leave. You don't have to put your name on it. It can be anonymous. And you can put it in the sacred manila envelope at the back before you leave. And we will definitely try and incorporate some of those questions into the teaching. If not, definitely at the end of the 5 weeks, we're going to do a Sunday morning dialogue where we try to answer or address some of those questions. So you can do that this morning. And here's where we started last week. The arrival of Jesus launched something revolutionary. That word revolutionary is a six-syllable word. It's incredibly important. It signaled the end of what we call the religious model, which is an entire approach to relating to God that goes all the way back to Egypt, to Assyria, to Persia, to Rome, to the Greeks. The Jewish religious system was built on the religious model, and it's still in evidence today throughout the world. And here I'm going to say this, like I said last week, even inside Christianity. In the religious model, there's always a sacred place. You know, it's a building or, you know, someplace that you go. There are sacred writings, whether they're oracles or sometimes written text. And they always have sacred men. If you notice inside the religious model, it's always men. And they're the ones that control and interpret the sacred writings and share those interpretations with the sincere or sometimes the superstitious, sometimes the scared followers. And they will tell them, here's how you're supposed to live. And if you don't live that way, then God will judge you or God will punish you in some way. And when Jesus showed up, what he began was a total departure, a revolutionary movement, total departure from the religious model. He ended the old covenant or the old agreement that was in place between God and people, and he established a new covenant, a revolutionary agreement between humanity and God that wasn't anything like the old one. And he gave us a new command. He said, this one command, which actually comes down to one verb, one word, would take precedence over all the other commands in the religious law. And if you get this one command right, you don't even need any of the other commands. And that's a little scary, right? And that's probably going to be the part that we're going to talk about that's going to make you feel, particularly Christians, it's going to make us feel a little uncomfortable. And in doing that, he took this new ethic, which we're going to talk about today, and he said, this ethic will trickle down into all your behaviors and relationships. And he called what he was inaugurating a new movement of people. Jesus said that he was going to build, the word is ecclesia, which means a new assembly, not an assembling of people at a place. That was the religious model. He said, I'm going to build a new gathering. I'm going to build a new congregation. In fact, one of the nicknames for the early church, for besides the word Christians, which is a nickname, was people of the way. People of the way. And that's a motion nickname. It's not a stationary nickname. But unfortunately, the powers that be took a German word that meant house of the Lord and forced it into the English translation of the New Testament. And that's where we get our word church from. We're not going back from that. It's kind of what we got. And it's why we often, or most often, think of church as a place rather than what Jesus meant. But Jesus began something revolutionary. It wasn't religion 2.0. It was a total and dramatic departure. And really, when we look at it, the religious model is built around a lowered standard. And Jesus came along and he raised the standard so high that nobody could meet it. And in doing that, he leveled the playing field, and then he offered himself as the sacrifice, the once and for all sacrifice for the sins of the entire world. And in the religious model, it required followers to come and offer a sacrifice to God, usually at a temple, to make peace with God. Jesus came and said, no more. I am the final sacrifice. And from now on, I don't want you to go to a temple or a place to make peace with God. You are the temple. I want you to go and make peace with your neighbor. Make peace with your neighbor. It's not about going to sacred places anymore. In fact, wherever you are, and if you go to a place that you consider to be sacred, whether it's a basilica, a church, whatever it may be, a temple, the people around you, in front of you, behind you, left or right, they are more sacred. They are more sacred than any place that your foot will ever stand. Jesus began something revolutionary. I hope we understand that. I hope we at least see that so we can start to process around it. And in the early days, Gentiles, which are non-Jews, began to flock to Jesus' new message because their religious system, they realized it just wasn't cutting it for them. It didn't work. And many of the Jews as well began to flock to the Jesus movement. In fact, almost all of Jesus' early or original followers were Jewish. But the Jewish Christians, that's right, Jewish followers of Jesus who embraced him as Messiah in the first century, they had a very specific tension that they had to manage that made it difficult for them to completely abandon the old covenant ways and fully embrace the Jesus movement. Because to them, these Jewish Christians, it didn't feel right to give up their customs and their traditions. And of course it wouldn't, because they had been steeped in those for centuries, and old ways die hard. And for them, and this is how we may identify with them a little bit, it seemed kind of sacrilegious and disrespectful to abandon their ways and tradition, the old covenant, Old Testament law, and everything that they've been brought up with. And this brings us to kind of a very important point that we're going to talk more about next week. It's the reason, actually, many of us will probably, if not already, will feel it this morning, will feel uncomfortable about this idea of letting go of the comfortable ways of the religious model that we've maybe grown very, very comfortable with. Here's the point. Our consciences determine what is religious reality for us, whether or not that's actual reality. We're going to talk about more about it next week, but our consciences determine what is religious for us, whether that reflects reality or not. And I think we've all experienced this at some point, right? Have you ever had somebody say to you, you shouldn't feel that way? You shouldn't feel that way. If you're married and you've ever said that, you understand what I'm talking about. But how did it work? Did it work for you? Or how about this one? You shouldn't feel guilty about that. And so let me ask this question. When they ask you that, or when they say that, Does it do away with your guilt? Do you feel no guilt after someone says you shouldn't feel guilty? Well, of course not, because our consciences have been fine-tuned to a certain set of values. And the way that you have been raised and the way religion, in whatever form that is, has been presented to you, it fine-tunes our conscience. And so that's why the next week, maybe this morning and the next couple of weeks, are going to be a little bit difficult for us. So I just want to encourage you to try, you know, that's why we're saying process, you know, download some of those questions and kind of process this with us. Moving on, but here's what happened. And it's totally understandable. The early Jewish Christians attempted to blend or assimilate the Jesus movement into their religious model. And of course they would, right? Because Jesus was the Messiah, right? They viewed him as an extension of the and a fulfillment of the Old Testament, so part of the Old Testament. So they just hung on to all of their old covenant, Old Testament law, and they kind of merged or blended Jesus' teaching into their religious model thinking. And then along comes the Apostle Paul to rescue really the church. And if you're not sure who Paul is, he wrote most of the letters that make up the New Testament of the Bible. But when he first arrives on the scene, he's not called Paul. His name is Saul. He's from a place called Tarsus. And he does not show up as a Christian. He does not show up as a follower of Jesus. In fact, he was a leader in the religious model. He was a Jewish Pharisee. And not only that, he claimed not only just to be a Pharisee, but to be the Pharisee of Pharisees. Like the, you know, king of the hill, the best. I mean, what it meant is that he'd pretty much memorized the Torah, and he actually taught the Old Testament, the Old Covenant religious law. And when he found out about Christianity, right, the Jesus movement, he viewed it as incredibly dangerous because it was so radically different than Judaism, which was the Jewish religious system, with its sacred places and sacred writings and sacred men who interpreted those writings for sincere followers. And so he said, God, I got this. Actually, he probably said, Yahweh, I got this. And he set out to single-handedly destroy the Jesus movement, this new movement of the followers of Jesus. And he would have done it because he was super type A personality, super committed. He would have gotten it done. But God got his attention. And on a road to a place called Damascus, he had a vision, he met Jesus and spoke to him face to face as Jesus spoke to him from heaven. And Saul of Tarsus, who set out to destroy the Jesus movement, becomes a Jesus follower and joins the Jesus movement and changes his name to Paul. And Paul, more than anyone else, understood that this Jesus thing is not a new and improved version of what already existed. It's a complete departure. And he began to teach the Jews, and he was a Jew, he began to teach the Jews, this isn't a continuation of Judaism. It's not an add-on. Jesus has begun something revolutionary. Paul understood how incredibly dangerous it would be to import the old covenant into Jesus' teaching in the new covenant. He knew that merging and blending the old with Jesus' new was not going to work. And so what he does is he goes out on a missionary journey. He had several, and he goes out on his first missionary journey to tell other people the good news about Jesus. And he goes to an area called Galatia, which is a Roman province in what is kind of now, I think, yeah, what's now modern-day Turkey. And if you've got your Bible with you, whether it's in, you know, print form, or you've got it on your phone, I would encourage you to open up to Galatians chapter 5. If you don't have it with you, it's okay. I'm going to have the verses up here, but, you know, if you have YouVersion or whatever you're using, that those are great ways to do that if you don't have a printed Bible. But it's Galatians chapter 5. And essentially, Paul goes to this area, and Jewish people embrace Jesus, and Gentiles, non-Jews, embrace Jesus. And they're beginning to connect and to, you know, kind of form these beautiful community of Jesus followers. And he plants these little ecclesias that Jesus was talking about, these little congregations of Jesus followers. And he leaves right? Does all that. He gets them all set, and they understand, you know, that Jesus is the fulfillment of the Old Testament covenant. And for Gentiles, they understand it's new, it's revolutionary, it's for them, it includes them. And then he leaves. And right after him come another group of missionaries from Jerusalem. These are a group of Jewish Christians, right? Jewish people who have also embraced the teaching of Jesus, embraced him as Messiah. And they tell the Gentile Christians in Galatia, hey, Paul didn't really tell you the whole story. If you want to be a follower of Jesus, you must become Jewish first, okay? Because after all, Jesus is Jewish, and he's the Messiah, and it makes sense if you're going to follow Jesus that you've also got to become Jewish. But here's where we're going to go this morning. We're going to see how emotional and how upset and angry the Apostle Paul was when he heard that these teachers were talking about this idea of mixing the old into the new. And so in this little New Testament document, which is really a letter that Paul wrote to the Christians in Galatia, we will see, I hope you'll see, I hope you'll be encouraged. I know it's going to be a bit of a challenge, but I hope you'll see what a big deal and actually how dangerous it is to try and blend Jesus into the religious model. In this letter, Paul talks about this other group of people that came behind him called the Judaizers. That's their name. They were, again, Jewish Christians who believed Gentiles, non-Jews, must convert to Judaism to join the Jesus movement, right? They were Christians, absolutely followers of Jesus, but they believed Jesus was an extension of the Old Testament, the Old Covenant, and if you wanted to be a Christian, you had to become Jewish first, which was very complicated for Gentiles. And for men, it required a little surgery, okay? I'm sure the men were like, hey, listen, I want to join. I really do, but the whole surgery thing, it's kind of a little, kind of throws me off. But the Judaizer said, hey, listen, if you want to follow Jesus, you got to be all in. I mean, right, he died for you. You can have a little surgery for him, you know, kind of thing. That was their message, and they were really, really passionate about it. But when the Apostle Paul finds out that after he left Galatia, these other teachers came in and began to undermine the purity of the Jesus movement and tried to blend and mix the old covenant with the Jesus movement, he became so upset and so angry. And you're probably asking, how angry? Stick around. I'll tell you this, it's R-rated anger. He was so angry because this was a big deal. It was a huge deal. I'm sure there were other people who were like, Paul, it's not really that big a deal. I mean, the old covenant has been around for centuries. I mean, what's the big deal? And so he writes this letter to the Galatians to tell them, here's why this is a big deal. If you try to blend the two, the religious model into Jesus' model, into Jesus' movement, you will dilute and pollute the message of Jesus because you don't understand that what Jesus initiated is so revolutionary. It's such a departure from the religious model that went before. This was a huge deal to the Apostle Paul. And I want to take us through Galatians chapter 5. I'm kind of going to do it a bit of a verse at a time to kind of help us experience in context why Paul was so intense about it. Because where we're going to go with this series is going to be a little bit unsettling. And our consciences are going to be like, I don't know. It feels uncomfortable to me. I'm not sure. And I'm pretty sure in the next couple of weeks, you might be just, you know, put your hands up saying, it's a cult. I'm out. But I just want us to understand what a big deal this is. And it should be freeing to us. And I think you'll see that. Not just to Paul, as it was to him, but a big deal to all of us. And why failing to get what Paul's talking about makes the church, makes us as followers of Jesus, so completely and unnecessarily resistible. So here's the Apostle Paul following up with his letter to the Galatians, the Galatian Christians, after these other Jewish Christians have tried to get them to blend the religious model into Jesus' movement. Here's what he says. It is for freedom that Christ has set us free. It is for freedom that Christ has set us free. And here's a little bit of an aside. When you think about your experience as a Christian, as a follower of Jesus, if it doesn't make you feel free, that might be an idea or might be a hint that you're yoked to the religious model. If your experience of following Jesus isn't described as freedom, then something is up. And stick around, we're going to talk more about that next week. So he says, it's for freedom that Christ has set us free. Stand firm then, and do not let yourselves be burdened again by a yoke of slavery. Mark my word is what he says next. And in the Greek language, they don't have punctuation marks, but the intensity of what Paul said here in his original letter was so strong that the translators and the publishers said, we need an exclamation mark there. He says this, mark my words, I, Paul, tell you that if you let yourselves be circumcised, Christ will be of no value to you at all. Now, if you were with us earlier in the spring, I said I thought that would be the last time I'd use the word circumcised on a Sunday morning. It's apparently happened a little bit quicker than I thought. So let me explain this little awkward word. Paul, in his what he said here, he's not against the procedure of circumcision. Don't worry, I don't have pictures. It's all good. In fact, Paul was Jewish. He was circumcised, right? All of Jesus' original followers were Jewish, and they were circumcised. Many of you have been circumcised. In fact, probably shouldn't have done that. Just don't put your hand up. I know there's, for a second there, some of you who are visiting are like, we picked the wrong morning to come and visit. And those of you who are watching online are like, we picked the best morning to be at home. Paul was not anti-circumcision, but in this context, it represented the old covenant. And last week, we learned that Jesus inaugurated a new covenant, which is a total departure from the old. And so Paul is like, wait. And he's not talking, you know, he's talking to Gentile men. He's not talking about babies or, you know, or young children. And he's saying, look, if you allow yourself to be circumcised, you are embracing the old covenant. You don't need to be circumcised. That was a sign for the nation of Israel that they belonged in an exclusive and unique relationship with God. That was for Jewish people as a sign of that covenant. This isn't it. It's a different covenant, a different agreement. Consequently, if you're circumcised as an adult, in this context, Christ is of no value to you. You've abandoned the new to embrace the old. And he goes on, as if they didn't get it. He says, again, I declare to every man who lets himself be circumcised that he is obligated to obey the whole law. That's a big deal, right? He narrows it down to exactly what they were trying to do. And it makes perfect sense that they would try to do that. They were trying to merge a little bit of Old Testament religious thinking, religious model thinking, and a little bit of Christianity, a little bit of what Jesus was talking about, and blend them together so you know that they would be comfortable. You know, they'd be like, you know what, we're not going to do everything. We're not going to do all that dietary stuff, right? But, you know, maybe no shellfish, all right? But let's just kind of blend things together. And I could see people going, Paul, what is the big deal? Paul's saying, look, if you think that all you've got to do is be circumcised and you get all the advantages of the old covenant, you're wrong. You got to do the whole thing. You got to dress right, you got to walk right, you got to eat right, you got to do the Sabbath. I mean, there are 630 something different laws that pertain to the Jewish religious system. And he's saying, don't kid yourself. You're either all in on that or you're not in at all. God has launched something revolutionary. That's a complete departure from all that has gone on before. And it's not just for Israel. It's for all nations, everyone. And circumcision is of no value anymore as it relates to your relationship with God. I just want to make sure, I want to be clear. This is not a series about whether or not you should be circumcised. Just want to make sure we don't get off track there. Paul then gets to the point when he says, you who are trying to be justified, that is, you who are trying to get in right with God, you who are trying to be justified by the law have been alienated. Now, remember who he's writing to here. He's writing to people who were Christians, right? You know, Gentile Christians. He says, you have been alienated. If you do that, you've been alienated from Christ. And I can imagine them saying, no, we haven't. We're just trying to be good Christians and take a little of this and a little of that and blend it together. I mean, what's the harm in that? And Paul's like, no, you have been alienated from Christ. And this is the scariest thing he says. And you have fallen away from grace. You've fallen away from grace. Now, what's he talking about? Let me explain this. I'll illustrate it this way. What they were doing would be like this situation. Let's say after the gathering, you know, this morning, let's say, or next, you know, couple of weeks, whatever. And you wanted to bless my family. And so you came to me and said, Dean, we want to give you a gift card to a restaurant, right? I won't tell you what restaurant that would be. It wouldn't be fair to use this platform, but it would be the Keg, just so you know. And imagine if you said, we've got you this $100 gift card. And I was like, man, I'm so grateful. Thank you so much. But I can't let you do that. Let me pay you for this. And you'd be like, no. It's a blessing. It's a gift. What if I said, well, let me give you $50. And you're like, no. It's a gift. What if I said, well, what about $25? And finally, you said, okay, I'll let you give me $25 for this $100 gift card. At that point, it's no longer a gift card. It's a $75 discount card, right? I just took the gift out of the card. And here's what Paul is saying. Grace is the hallmark of the Christian experience. Grace is God knew everything about us. He knows everything about you and chose to love you anyways. Grace is there are no secrets with our Heavenly Father, and because of Jesus, he refuses not to call you one of his children. Grace is you don't deserve it. And the moment, this is Paul talking, the moment you start trying to earn it through surgery or law or keeping obedience to rules or whatever, anything else, you have done away with grace. Even if it's at the $5 level, it becomes a discount and it's not a gift. And grace is a gift. And the moment you start bargaining with God, the moment you start trying to earn your way and say, God, look what I did. You know, the moment that you think you've offered something to God so good that you think God says, okay, that works. You're in and now you're one of my favorites. The moment you adopt any of that religious model thinking, you've fallen away from grace. I can't think of a more discouraged or upsetting or sad phrase. You've fallen away from grace. What he's saying is so extreme. Really, it really is. It's so extreme. But just wait. I haven't even got to the extreme part yet. He says this, for in Christ Jesus, in other words, as a follower of Jesus, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision has any value. Paul would say, if somebody thinks they have reasons to put confidence in anything else, he says, I have more. I was circumcised on the eighth day. I'm a Jew. I'm a religious leader. As for righteousness based on obeying the law, I was faultless. But that doesn't do me any good anymore, Paul would say. That's not why God loves me. And he would say, if you're a Gentile and you weren't circumcised, it doesn't matter. Because all of that was done away with, was fulfilled in Jesus. This is something revolutionary. And then Paul says something that is so extreme. Hold on. So extreme that most of us probably don't even know that it's actually in the New Testament. In fact, if I came out here this morning and didn't read the verse that I'm going to show you, and I, you know, kind of preached a little sermon on what I'm about to show you that Paul said, and I didn't show you the verse, and I just said, here's how I think we should live, and this is what I think we would do, I guarantee you would say, you've lost it, Dean. You have abandoned our beliefs. This is how extreme what Paul is about to say is, and please, I just want to encourage you, please listen to this. What Paul is about to say addresses the reason, I believe, that church and Christians have become unnecessarily resistible. Because so much that is resistible about us, I believe, and makes some people feel unsafe about Christians or in Christianity is the fact that we have resisted what Paul is about to say. That's why I said last week that people, things that people resist about the church are the very things that the church should resist about itself. And now, this is coming from the Apostle Paul, who wrote over half the New Testament. And the reason you're probably a Christian is because of the missionary work that Paul did centuries ago. Listen to what this ex-Pharisee, who memorized most of the Old Testament and who used to hate the Jesus movement, said. Are you ready? The only thing that counts is faith expressing itself through love. Awkward silence. This is the equivalent of a mic drop. I mean, what's all this about? Paul, are you saying that the only thing that counts? The only thing, like there's really probably 10 things, but this is one of those 10 things? Paul's like, no. But aren't there like 10 commandments and like 630 other religious laws? Yeah, Paul says the only thing that counts is faith expressing itself through love. I know you're probably feeling uncomfortable, like, Dean, you're leaving something out. Paul said the only thing that counts. How many things count? One thing. The only thing that counts is faith, and is faith expressing, and it's this little Greek word that says working it out, working it out, working it out. The only thing that matters, the only thing of any value is our faith expressing itself through love. Circumcision and all that it represents, the whole religious model, it's self-centered, it's me-centered. It starts with wanting something from God, and it's based on the underlying question, what's in it for me? So we process that forward by going to God and saying, how am I doing? How am I doing? Did you see this? I did this. I didn't do that. I stayed away from that group of people and sin and sinners. Are we good? Are we good? Are we good? And it's all vertical, right? It's all vertical. And Paul says that day is over. If you're a Christian, if you're a follower, if you believe or trust that Jesus is the Messiah, that he died for your sins, you're in. Quit worrying about what God thinks of you. If you believe that God sent his son, and whatever amount of faith you have in that he sent his son into the world and that he died for you, you're in. Think about it this way. If someone will die for you, they are for you. You never have to go to bed at night wondering how you and God are doing. So Paul would say, so quit looking up and start looking around. Because the only thing of any value is how you treat other people, not how you treat God. God is fine. And that's a very, 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 very big deal. Very big deal. Because if in your thinking, if your whole approach to God is, God, I hope we're good. I hope we're good. That's religious model thinking. Paul says that day is over. It was valuable. It got us to the place where we are today, but it's history. Because Jesus completed it. He fulfilled it. Fulfilled all of what the old covenant was intended to do. It's why Paul says, it's through the Spirit that we eagerly await by faith the righteousness for which we hope. We don't earn righteousness by obedience to God. Then Paul goes on to say, you were running a good race. You were doing great. You understood, you understood how Jesus had fulfilled the old covenant. And you were leaving sort of your pagan religious model ways behind and how Jesus had done all this for you. Everybody was doing good. You were running such a good race. And then he uses a little bit of wordplay. He says, who cut in on you to keep you from obeying the truth? And then he illustrates how dangerous it is to blend. He says, a little yeast works through the whole batch, right? A little yeast, a single cell fungus. All of you who are bakers, that's what it is. That ought to make you feel good. A single cell fungus, just a pinch. If you put it into this dense, ooey gooey dough and you come back later, the whole thing has changed. He's saying a little bit of that religious model thinking, a little bit of, of legalism, a little bit of gracelessness, a little bit of what's in it for me, how am I doing? A little bit of that, Paul says, pollutes the whole thing. It only takes a small dose of the wrong thing to corrupt the whole thing, and that's what Paul is saying. It only takes a small dose of the old thing to corrupt and pollute the revolutionary thing that Jesus has begun. This isn't a blend, a mix, or it's not even a balance. It's a complete departure from the old. It's not religion 2.0. It's revolutionary. And you kind of maybe get a feeling of the, you know, some of the emotions of Paul a little bit. You might want to say to Paul, yo, bro, just ease up a bit, right? I've got my way that I'm comfortable with. You know, other Christians have their way of, you know, that they're comfortable with. So let's just hold hands and sing, you know, Kumbaya, right? We're different kinds of Christians. Some people are more traditional or conservative in their beliefs. Paul's like, no. You don't understand. The Apostle Paul understood how dangerous this would and where it would lead to. In fact, it's led to where many of us struggle today, 2,000 years later. And here's the R-rated part. Here's the R-rated part that shows just how angry he became over this issue of blending the old with the new. Are you ready? Hold one another close. As for those agitators, right, the people who came in behind him and corrupted and polluted his message, right, that's who he's talking to. He says, I wish they would go the whole way and emasculate themselves. Awkward silence. Right, what he's saying is, if you're going to cut, just go all the way. Right, I just want to tell you, that's in the Bible. I didn't make that up. That's Paul. That's Galatians 5:12. That's what he's saying. Apokopto is the actual Greek word. It actually sounds violent. It literally means to cut it off. I know you're like, please stop. Please stop. Just as an aside, I want to let you know that when I was in high school at our church, we used to do these New Year's Eve gatherings called watch night services. At midnight, they would hand out these little promises to everybody. And there are different promises from the Bible. And I always wanted to find out where they kept those ahead of time so that I could slip in Galatians chapter 5, verse 12 into that mix and then just watch who got that one on New Year's Eve. But anyways, I digress. You're probably thinking, Paul, that's so extreme. And Paul would respond, you don't understand what's at stake. It's as if Paul could see into the future. And I'll tell you why he knew what would happen. Because Paul was front and center of the religious model in the first century. He was one of the sacred men. And even knowing all the goodness of God's law and what it had done through the nation of Israel, Paul saw front and center what can happen when the religious model goes off the rails. And he knew if you try to blend the religious model with Jesus, you will lose the absolute best. It won't be 50-50. It won't be 80-20. It'll be 99% religious model thinking and 1% Jesus. And Paul is saying that's how big a deal this is. I wish then people who advocated a blended model with religion into the Jesus movement, I wish they would go all the way and just take themselves out. It was that big a deal. Paul knew what would happen if we try to blend Jesus with the religious model. It's what always happens. People become self-righteous and hypocritical. Because what we do is we reduce and lower God's standard of love until it's something that I can live with, that I can do, something that doesn't bother my conscience. And then Jesus shows up on the scene and says, you've heard it said, do not murder. And people would be like, and I used to think the same way, like, well, it's not a problem. I'm never going to do that, and I haven't done it, right? No problem. I'm good. But Jesus says, I tell you, anybody who is angry or who hates their brother or sister is guilty of murder. Matthew chapter 5, Jesus goes on to say in the Sermon on the Mount, you've heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Jesus jacked up the standard so high that nobody could keep the standard. In the religious model, what we do is we bring the standard down low. And then we have to keep becoming more and more self-righteous and more hypocritical. And Paul knew this. Paul knew that at some point the sacred writings would be manipulated, right? It says here, it says here, it says here, it says here. You shouldn't, you should. right? And ultimately, people would be mistreated. And I don't know if you've ever been mistreated in a church or by somebody who means well. I have. I'm ashamed to say I've probably been that person too. Someone who comes and they'll look you in the eye and they'll put up a rule and they'll raise it above the one command that Jesus gave, the one thing, the main thing, the only thing of any value. Here's what Paul knew. If we cling to old things, we will miss the main thing. And so he continues, and here's the main thing. He says, you, my brothers and sisters, were called to be free, but don't use your freedom to indulge the flesh. Rather, serve one another humbly in love. Serve one another humbly in love. This should be really helpful for many of us who are thinking that this, Dean, what you're really talking about sounds like it's just this ooey gooey, just do whatever you want because the wheels are off and there are no rules and we just do whatever we want. But that's not love. That's not loving either. And it's also not about a game that we play with God where we say, well, I can just go out and do whatever I want and I can just come and confess my sins and God's going to forgive me and then I can go out and fill up my sin bucket again and I can just keep coming back. Well, Paul says, whoa. If you're worried that this main thing, this only thing, is going to make everything so freewheeling and that there are no rules and you can do whatever you want, then you don't understand what the main thing is. He says, my brothers and sisters, church, followers of Jesus, you don't use your freedom to indulge the flesh, to indulge selfishness. Here's how you use your freedom. You serve one another humbly in love for the entire law. And he's talking here about the old covenant law in Leviticus. He's quoting Leviticus. He says the entire law is fulfilled, is accomplished, is done. Put a check mark beside it. Is fulfilled by keeping this one command. Love your neighbor as yourself. And Paul's quoting the old covenant, right? He's quoting Leviticus. He's saying to his Jewish followers, and he's saying to others, it was there all the time, right? This truth that would one day be expanded to include all of humanity was there because buried in the old covenant was the one thing that would inform the rest of the things. Here's what Paul is saying to his Jewish brothers and sisters. We had the main thing the whole time. It's still there. Love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus would say, love God, love your neighbor, love your enemy. The rest is detail. Love God, love your neighbor, love your enemy. The rest is detail. In fact, the way that you love God is by loving your neighbor. The religion model says, God, how am I doing? How am I doing? The Jesus way says, look around at the people around you. You'll see how you're doing. The religion model says, what's in it for me? So God, are we fine? Jesus' revolutionary way says, we're fine. Would you go and get things right with the people around you? Because when things are right with the people around you, things are right with us. It's why Paul could say the only thing that counts is faith expressing itself through love. And when we get this right, it changes everything. It absolutely changes everything because it is revolutionary. When we get this right, we'll pray differently. We'll look at other people differently. We'll look at other groups that we've kind of said, make me feel uncomfortable. We'll look at them differently. We'll worship differently. We'll see sin differently. When we get it right, we embrace it, our relationship, our experience with Jesus will be characterized by freedom more than anything else. And when we get this right, we will treat other people better. And if this feels extreme, it might. It means that you have been paying attention. If it feels wrong and too unstructured, that's exactly how the Jewish Christians felt in the first century and how many of the Gentile believers felt. And in fact, by the third century, the whole Christian community had said, we just can't do that, and they began to blend it all. But just imagine for a moment, how different our homes, our workplaces, our neighborhoods, our cities would be if just Christians decided there's really only one thing that matters. It's my faith in Jesus manifesting itself in actual love just like Jesus did. What's most important to God is how I treat other people, not how I feel about them. It's how I treat them. Jesus' command to love isn't a command to feel love. It's to act with love. That's why Paul says you can't blend. Because the moment you do that, you begin to look up and you evaluate how God views you. To try to evaluate how God views you, we take our eyes off the people that are most important, his creation, most important to our Heavenly Father. And as a result, I think this is true. This is a hard word. If we're completely honest with ourselves, how often do we take Jesus' new command, his new covenant, his new ethic, his new standard of actually loving others and reduce it or cheapen it or rationalize it into tolerance? Why we do that? Because it's easier. It's a doable standard. It eases our conscience. We reduce Jesus' beautifully, beautiful standard of the love that he showed. We reduce it to not throwing rocks at our enemies or people that make us uncomfortable. An attitude of tolerance fools us into thinking that we're making God happy by including the law with grace, but it's just another blatant attempt at blending. We can do so many other good things. We can. We can mean so well, but if there's no love, if it's not love, it's just the religious model and it amounts to nothing. And really, if I think about it, how is tolerating somebody any different than ignoring them? Jesus doesn't give us that option. Come back next week, we're going to talk about that. There's no loopholes. Jesus' new command isn't to tolerate one another as I have tolerated you. It was love one another in the same way I have loved you. And Jesus gives us a new question to ask, and it's not what's in it for me. Instead, what does love require of me?